And welcome back. So once again, tonight's fifth episode, which is part of a 10-part limited series, is brought to you by the Mohawk Super Bingo on the 138. And again, for those of you who are just joining us, on tonight's show, we have DeLuisa the Deer and Harley Delarone, who last week, for those of you who listened in or who might not have listened in, we were talking a lot about just history in general. We were looking at a whole lot of variety of times and eras, and we kind of were all over the map. But really, it was just this whole idea around the importance of our history from our story and our voices and the way it empowers you and understanding more. And so in our discussions, one of the ideas that they had come up with and wanted to talk about is our actual community here in Kahnawake, because we have such a long, rich history. I think we just passed our 300th anniversary, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
We're maybe a year or two past now, or
a year past.
Yeah. And so on tonight's show, we're going to be kind of looking more in depth at our history here in Kahnawake for those who might not know the rich history that we have, you know, the political, economic, religious history, what have you. So I'd like to start with DeLuisa Day, mm-hmm. and just your thoughts on this 300th anniversary and being here for so long and what really brought us here to this area.
Well, as always, anytime I talk about history, I have to start with a disclaimer. The disclaimer is, you know, it's our 300th anniversary or 301st anniversary in this location, this specific location. But of course, we believe that this is our traditional territory. And really, what happened in the 1660s is that we made our way back into this part of our northern frontier of our territory.
So let me just throw a really quick curveball here at you, Justin. This whole idea that we're hearing that this wasn't really our territory, uh-huh. you know, this, the whole St. Lawrence Iroquois, and that we're not really that, it's not really, you know, mm-hmm. this is the debate out in academia, right? Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I guess I'll start. I'll just say that I think that the whole St. Lawrence Iroquois thing is politically motivated to try to substantiate that we're not Aboriginal to this specific area. Mm. And I mean, we heard that even back in 1990 saying that how could the people of Gunasadag and Gunawaga have ancestral claims to this territory because they themselves are immigrants to this territory. Mm-hmm. So, which is a complete falsehood. The only thing that I'd like to say about that even might be controversial here is that it's there's definitely archaeological evidence that there was Iroquoian people that was here mm-hmm. for at least 2,000 years, but there's also archaeological evidence that shows that Algonquin people were at least on the island of Montreal mm-hmm. for at least 2,000 years. So that kind of validates the theory that Montreal might have even been a no man's land, where it was a trade and diplomatic hub where people came for treaty making for trade purposes. Mm-hmm. But it is clear that at least when Cartier came, that it was longhouses. It was definitely Iroquois, Iroquoian village. Mm-hmm. And something always stuck out in my mind, something that Gerald Alfred said, is that it's really a circular argument, the whole St. Lawrence Iroquois thing. Again, something that the claim is that the St. Lawrence Iroquois were a distinct nationality of Iroquoian people that was separate from the Gunyakahaga, separate from the Haudenosaunee. Mm. But the argument might be more that whoever was here are our ancestors one way or the other, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. And I actually brought a couple of notes here, but I have a quote of what Gerald said here, and he said, even if we grant that the people who lived here were the first, who lived here when the first French explorers arrived, were not politically organized members of the Haudenosaunee, and were either reorganized as the Mohawk Nation or assimilated into the Mohawk Nation later, it is still undeniable that the native people of this territory were the ancestors of the Mohawks of Kahnawake. Mm-hmm. So one way or the other, this is our ancestral territory.
Yeah, because even as we know, as time went on, Kahnawake, today we consider it just a primarily Mohawk community, mm-hmm. right? But that wasn't always the case. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always this question today about why do we have so many snipes here? Mm-hmm. You know, where do these clans come from? Where do those? And it just shows that we were like a real homogenous community that had a whole lot of different peoples who were coming in, and the interactions were vast.
Well, the way I understand it also in that same line you're talking about was that even on in the records of the Europeans, the French, the Jesuits, you know, their records are that some of the early families that were here were Oneida. And maybe even an Onondaga. And a few Ganyagahaga. That was obviously, and what were the reasons, real reasons for those people coming to this area is another question. Mm-hmm. But I think the important thing is that as time went on, it became culturally and more of a it was not ethnic, but it was culturally a Ganyagahaga community. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it kind of ties into what just what the Uiza there was just saying.
That it's not to say that we didn't have Mohawks here and families, right? No. Our ancestors, because prior to Kahnawake being here, we had the movement from down the river, right? Yeah. Going all the way down to La Prairie. Yeah. And
well, that's what I was actually referring to, the very first, the Gantage, in, I believe it was the early 1660. That was 1660 was about probably
1667. I think it was when they went to Gondaga.
So, and if we jump to that, and you look at one of the things, you look at what were the motivations. I don't know if you were going to speak about, but that's a very intriguing question or something to look at. And what were the motivations? You know, was it just a natural, you know, part of, well, this is our territory. I like to look at it as it was a reassertion of our claim to this territory. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I mean, it's been painted or attempted to be painted by the European, the settlers and their documentation as it was a Christian, to be closer to the Christians. And there was, and I'm sure there was some of that. There was, but I think it was a mixture of.
It's not so black and white.
Economic. Right? It was an economic. Yeah. It was a jurisdictional, if you want to say, political, social, and of course, it was a spiritual or religious. I think
it's definitely a long series of events that led to it. It's not so cut and dry, especially the whole Christianity part, which I think really came about later. I think that the main reasons for resettling the North had more to do with trade and diplomacy. Mm-hmm. I if you want, I could just share some research that I did on that specific era. Well, of course, we didn't start off on the right foot with the French, even going back to Cartier. Mm-hmm. But by the time Champlain comes here in 1608, 1609, the first thing he does is attack a Mohawk village.
Yeah.
And that really and made an alliance with our enemies at that time, who were the Algonquin. That set really about maybe 50, 60 years of warfare between ourselves, the French, and the Algonquin. And it started really coming to a head around in the 1660s. And in 1665, there was an Onondaga diplomat. His name was Gardaguje. And Gardaguje was trying to put an end to these hostilities between the Haudenosaunee and the French. And he traveled himself to meet with Jean Talon. I mean, we hear that name around Montreal quite a bit. Jean Talon was the intendant for New France at the time. Mm-hmm. And he crafted some terms of how a relationship between the French and the Haudenosaunee could work. And it was really based off of really the tenets of the Turo, saying that we would coexist in this area, but there would be no interference between
because prior peoples. To this time, around 1613, and again, academics try to argue this whole event, right? But the whole starting of this Turo Treaty or agreement that we had with the Dutch.
That was already established by this point,
so
for
we
sure.
We had a European ally at that time who was providing us with the needs of weapons, resources.
Sure.
Now we're into this era.
Yeah, so in 1665, he makes this deal. Some months later, going to 1666, he convinces the Cayugas, the Senecas, to partake in this this agreement, this potential treaty. It's not really solidified yet. But there was two nations that were holding out. That was the Oneidas and the Ganyakahaga were holding out of this treaty. So in the summer of that year, two things happened. Firstly, the Oneidas are interested in partaking in discussions with Jean Talon about Garaguji's proposed treaty. But before that happens, anybody, you guys know where Île Lamont is in Vermont?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a fort that's there, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So at the time, at this place, there was a garrison, a French garrison that ran that fort. And it was under the direction of a French official who was in charge of that garrison. His name was Marquis de Tracy. Again, that's a name that we see in our area. Mm-hmm. And so it turns out that some French soldiers decide to go hunting in the area of Île Lamont. There's all islands, if you're familiar with that area. And they stumble upon a Mohawk war party, and they're taken prisoner, and they're taken back to the Mohawk Valley. Turns out that it's Marquis de Tracy's nephew that they got and they brought back to the Mohawk Valley. And so in the meantime, a group of Oneidas are making their way to Quebec City to talk peace. Mm-hmm. And this just happens at the same time that Marquis de Tracy's nephew is kidnapped. So when by the time he gets to Quebec City, they kidnap the Oneida delegation. And as they're being held there, Marquis de Tracy sends 500 soldiers that winter to come and attack Ganyonge.
Was this the same group? I know there was a time in history when the French had sent this elite group in.
That was the following year. The following year. Yeah, so we're probably in January of 1666 now. Mm-hmm. And this, 500 troops get as far as Schenectady or Saratoga, one of those Dutch settlements that was down there. Mm-hmm. And probably a third of their number froze and starved to death. So they got, they went into this Dutch settlement and they said, "Can you help revive us, please? We're dying." And this Dutch village said, "All right, listen, you know our allies are the Ganyakahaga. So if we help you, it has to be on the condition that you go back to New France." Well, they were in no position to really argue, so they were nursed back to health and they made their way back to Île Lamont. Mm-hmm. And by the time they get to the Lake Champlain area, they stumbled across a Mohawk war party and another third of that original 500 got killed. So it was a failed mission. It was definitely a failed mission. This infuriated Jean Talon. It infuriated Marquis de Tracy. And I believe another delegation of Haudenosaunee, I think there was 22 member delegation, goes to Quebec City to like kind of smooth things over. Mm-hmm. And they get kidnapped. They get kidnapped at this time. Mm-hmm. And Marquis de Tracy assembles this elite force that you're talking about, 1,300, the largest mass of colonial troops up until that point, to go in and invade the valley. So, and there's some Algonquins that are a part of that number, but 1,300 altogether. And they get as far as, by the way, there's a parley that takes place just before this invasion, the second invasion happens, a parley that takes place in Albany that's mediated by the Dutch. And it's between the French and the Ganyakahaga. And it wasn't too long after that that they secured the release of Marquis de Tracy's nephew, but they didn't get the release of these 22 diplomats So in October or September, I can't really remember exactly the month, but in 1666, this large group goes, and they get as far as about Lake George, and there's a Mohawk scouting party that notices this large mass of soldiers, and they make their way back to the valley. And presumably what happens is they tell everybody, and it's clear that those, at least those first few villages, didn't have a chance in repelling the attack of such a big number, because by the time that the French soldiers do get to the eastern door, those maybe two or three villages are emptied out. And so I imagine what probably happened is that those the people lived in those villages went further west, maybe fortified themselves amongst the Oneidas so they could, have a stronger defensive force. But we don't know. We really don't know. Mm. But what happens is these French soldiers end up burning down those villages. About probably two or three villages they burnt down. They destroyed the food stores, they burnt the fields, just to make it as hard as they could to start those villages back. And but Jean Talon was pretty upset by the whole thing. He was upset that they didn't give us the punch in the nose that they needed to end this conflict once and for all. Mm-hmm. And he knew that because of this attack, there would be retaliations. There would be endless Mohawk retaliations.
Kick the hornet's nest,
that's
right?
It. That's mm-hmm. it. So Jean Talon says, send word back to the valley, to Gagnonga, and say that we're going to release these diplomats, these 22 diplomats that we have, and the Oneidas that they had mm-hmm. Kidnapped before, and that we're ready to talk real peace. So they sent a delegation in November, I think, of November or December of 1666. And they go to Quebec City, and they ratify Gordeguj's proposed treaty. And really, here's the real politics of it. It's really the St. Lawrence River Valley and access to the Great Lakes. That was a prized location.
Yeah.
We have to remember that the fur trade was in full bloom, and by this time, furs had already become depleted in the south. Hmm. And we looked at the north saying, that's our territory, and we should be able to hunt and make a living wherever we want in our territory. So that's why we were attacking French settlements all over the St. Lawrence, because that was our traditional territory. Mm-hmm. So the deal that was made is that we wouldn't interfere with any French settlements. They wouldn't interfere with our presence in the north again, the northern part of our territory, including access to the Great Lakes. So that was the real prize, was that geographic location, because it was basically the economic highway of the New World. Mm-hmm. So that was, I guess, led to the events of us coming to repopulate. And if I could just tie it up real quick, in 1667, or probably the winter going into 1667, there was a family of Oneidas who were traveling to Montreal so they could get medical attention for something I guess they couldn't deal with back home. And because this peace was now established, they had free access to, you know, engage with the French in peaceful terms. And when they do get to Montreal, they realize that the winter had come real rapidly and there was no way for them to go back to their homeland. So they said, you might as well stay here to the Oneida family. They said, you know, on the south shore of the river, there's a Jesuit retreat. Maybe you could go stay with them. And so they spent the winter, this Oneida family, in La Prairie. And as the spring came, I can't really say if they sent word back to Oneida or if they traveled back and then came back, but they fell in love with the area. And a bunch of other Oneida families ended up coming up. And the Jesuits thought it was in their best interest to try to attract our people up here for religious purposes.
Conversion.
Buffer.
Yeah, as a buffer. Like a yeah, buffer, definitely.
Having
definitely.
People there while, yeah. you know, if something does go wrong or, yeah. you know, and then you've got people here already. Yeah. And there's a better chance. But there's a lot of reasons.
Sure.
And I think that your story really is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that it talks about is that we can't just look at the history and how just a date, a whole bunch mm-hmm. of people simplify, they came by, boom, that's the reason mm-hmm. they said it was religious, boom. It's never that simple. Mm-hmm. You have to look at all of these things, the motivations, what mm-hmm. was going on, as I said, economically, sure. and a lot of it is what was happening to the regular person, mm-hmm. you know, in their lives, whether it be their sicknesses. Mm-hmm. You mentioned people get sick, you know, and then maybe they saw that there was, you speculated, it could have been something they could not mm-hmm. get or whatever. They come to look at. But they want peace. Mm-hmm. People want peace. Mm-hmm. They're not searching for. Mm-hmm. We read and we hear stories about that, and we talk about it in other historians have talked about how it was a very difficult time.
Sure.
It was a very chaotic, or it had all of these new things that come to our society, new ways of thinking, yeah. new mm-hmm. ways of, and it was upsetting.
Mm-hmm. And they were
trying to deal with it.
And they were adapting, right?
Yeah. yeah.
Something one of our academics, our indigenous academics, Jose Barrero, in one of his interviews, he said, the thing you see with indigenous people, and listening to your story, it reminded me of a quote that he had said was, as indigenous people, we always had resistance and adaption, mm-hmm. resistance and adaption. And we always knew that you couldn't just focus on one or the other. Mm-hmm. You had to find that middle ground. He said, because if there was just continuous fighting and resistance, mm-hmm. well, we could have just been, wipe ourselves out or right. whatever. You know, it's just constant warfare and fighting. Mm-hmm. And the adaption, he said, was that we understood there were certain things that we could take from their society mm-hmm. to adapt our ways, but don't totally do it because then you lose who you are. He said, so it was always this kind of, mm-hmm. Back and forth, even with ourselves.
Yeah.
What do we resist? What mm-hmm. do we adapt to? And how do we continue forward as this sovereign people,
That reminds me, a little note on the subject of adaptation and resistance. Just a quick story that I found it in the records. I thought it was so cool. Okay. When we made peace with the French at that time and we started coming to repopulate the northern frontier of our territory, mm-hmm. One of the conditions that I forgot what that was left out, that was included, I should say, in Gurguj's treaty was to allow Jesuits free passage into the Mohawk Valley. Because, well, we all know that it didn't really go too well for the Jesuits that kind of came around.
Yeah, a little bit earlier.
No,
yeah.
Father Jobes.
We had those stories. Yeah.
So there was a whole, I guess, year before it became, or a few months anyway, before it became hospitable for the Jesuits to actually travel to the valley as part of this condition. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, ledgers show in colonial records that the Ganyakahaga specifically, when they were going to do trade in Albany, weren't really buying so much the normal trade goods like irons and nails and
pots
and that kind of thing. What they were buying was an extraordinary amount of firepower. And I think that they...
It's an arms race, right?
For us? Arms race.
Yeah.
Early arms race.
And I think that the reason was, after what happened the year before with this 1,300 troop invasion of our territory, we didn't want to get caught with our pants down like that again. So in the following year, the capital village of the Mohawk Nation at the time, and I'm drawing a blank for the name, but if it comes back to me, I'll tell you. But when the Jesuits were coming, they were flanked by some French soldiers that escorted them. But as a show of force, around this palisaded village that these Jesuits were coming, there was 200 warriors that made two lines that the Jesuits and their French escorts had to go through in order to get into the palisade. And one of the coolest things that these records show is that there's two swivel cannons mounted on the top of the palisade.
Yeah, now, could you?
Yeah, and one of the books that was talking about this says, no doubt this is probably what they're buying in Albany at the time. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's in their interest in Albany that we're being well armed against the French, because mm-hmm. they're kind of saying, by this point, I think that the English are now taking over.
It was the English.
Yeah, yeah. But could you imagine these big swivel cannons on the top of a wooden palisade? So that's resistance, that's adapting.
Yeah, and it's even looking at the adaptation, mm-hmm. the whole resistance, it went into our political outlook. Mm-hmm. It went into our military way mm-hmm. that our warriors had, waged war in that time in the woods. There was always this means. And you were mentioning about looking at history and like the reasons behind a lot of certain things, right?
Yeah.
Today, it's hard for us even to just think about, because we have the characters that we see that they wrote about mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. You mentioned mm-hmm. some of them. Mm-hmm. What about all of the other factors? We look today in our own community, mm-hmm. And we're such a, a wide range of people and personalities mm-hmm. that are driving history forward. So you have mm-hmm. to think at that time, yeah. too, it was mm-hmm. the same type of thing going on.
And if someone asks you a question, someone were to come and ask you, or you were visiting somewhere, let's say, and you were asking a question of an issue that's going on in a more modern, you couldn't answer that mm-hmm. just with a short one sentence or nope. two sentences. There is just no way anyone going anywhere mm-hmm. trying to explain why the Ganyagahag of Ganawage or Ganawageruna are doing this. Mm-hmm. Why don't they? Why not this? And mm-hmm. you would have a be very, very challenged to explain it mm-hmm. in a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. And why, you know, and looking back, you have to look at those events.
What were the circumstances?
And the yeah. circumstances that were going on at that mm-hmm. time. And people worried about their day-to-day life.
Yeah.
You know, feeding their family, being in peace, you know, and those are the basic, being able to make your own decisions, not have someone come and tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm. And you think, going back to your mm-hmm. story to mm-hmm. the Oisa Day, is mm-hmm. that this happened over 300 years ago,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we can still draw so many lessons about yeah. how our old-timers dealt with that mm-hmm. yeah. issue that came to their borders at that time, mm-hmm. right? And really looking at and taking it and saying, well, how do we apply things like that today to, mm-hmm. you know, taking the lessons, the political lessons, the way they dealt with things, the resistance and adaption mm-hmm. idea, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because we can see from there, like in history, it's kind of like the water when you touch the surface and it ripples out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they couldn't have seen really what were mm-hmm. the ripples from those events, mm-hmm. but there was wide-ranging ripples that went out afterwards, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, well, we were talking off air earlier and I brought up Joseph Brant.
Mm.
It's easy for us yeah. to look back and say, this guy caused so much trouble for us in history.
In hindsight, we'll say he was a villain.
Yeah.
He was a traitor. Yeah. He was this,
yeah.
he was that.
But if you put yourself in his shoes at that time, how did he look at things?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not... In hindsight, is 2020, eh?
Yeah.
But if you look at probably the way he looked at things, let's imagine those circumstances today. If we had an opportunity to make an alliance with the United States
yeah.
or Canada, if they happened to fight, what would we do?
Mm-hmm.
Would we proclaim neutrality, which we always believe is the correct answer, or would we side with the side that was more likely to win, mm-hmm. the more militarily superior side? Because we're, you know, when we look at French and Indian Wars, when we look at American Revolution, we always played each side off, right? And try to get a better deal. But American Revolution, it kind of didn't really work out for us in that case. But let's look at ourselves right now. If we had to make an alliance with the United States or Canada, what would we do?
How would it work out? How would it
yeah.
out? Would we even?
And what if Canada just... won?
yeah.
And really, that's what happened with Joseph Brant, is that He backed the wrong horse.
He went with it was
the more logical horse, mm-hmm. right? And he probably envisioned, you know, how life would be if it went the way.
And you're under pressure. You're under great pressure either way.
You know, even for us, we like to say Joseph Brant.
Yeah.
Joseph Brant.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Brant was one man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know. But he was able to, but I'm sure there was so many other mm-hmm. men and mm-hmm. women who were there behind him saying, you know, he was the charismatic one.
Yeah. He was the charismatic.
And, you know, the non-natives wrote about him
yeah.
because
yeah.
he was right in their face. He was mm-hmm. right at their meetings. But, you know, we don't know who were all of these other characters behind him.
I just have to say, I'm not endorsing Joseph Brant.
Yeah, no.
No, I totally get what you're... Yeah,
but it's
understandable
because
yeah.
we can look back now in hindsight
yeah.
and mm-hmm. say, well, this is what happened. We can learn from their mistakes,
yeah.
you know? But, and are we going to learn from their mistakes?
And like you said, with the ripples, we're still dealing with the ripples of yeah. the decisions that man made.
Yeah, or those know? People.
Those people,
at that time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
the nations and the like, because, yeah, yeah it's 300 years, 250 mm-hmm. years later, we're still mm-hmm. reeling from a lot of that. And it seems like there's even still old animosities that go back to that
sure.
time. You know, it's...
Yeah.
Those events, and I don't want to bring in more recent, I don't want to get away from that time, but those events, we look at it and we say, you know, we can't wrap our head around or our brains around, you know, that, and we try to take Joseph Grant's actions and put it to the present day, but go even more recently, and I don't want to get into that, but take the St. Lawrence Seaway. And you see what when I was a teacher, I had often, and you probably got something similar, or anybody come and says, why didn't they just, why didn't they just stop them from doing it? Why didn't, like, you know, take out the guns and stand there, or stand in front, tie yourself to this, whatever. But you, that was what, 50, you know, 55 years ago, 57 years ago. And the thing is,
a different time.
The thing is, times were different than what they are. You cannot put your sense of your world today in transplanted in the back and expect that those people there are going to make the same kind of decisions you would, because you don't, you have all this other experience.
And, and then would 1990 have happened if the Seaway didn't, what I mean,
I understand
what you mean. What I mean is, I've talked to people when I was a teenager and said, man, how come you, like you're saying, how come you, and the answer is, well, that's what happened, but we always said we wouldn't let something like that happen again. And so that kind of resistance, again, adapting and resisting, it kind of snowballs. Would we have been fortified enough to go through with something like 1990 if we weren't emboldened by what happened with the Seaway?
And you even, having that...
not just the Seaway, but
other events that happened, the events that led towards it. And and we have to go even further back, you know? The founding of our Confederacy says that when they were told, think seven generations into the future. I mean, that's even hard for us to think today. Seven generations is how many years down the line, right? But this is something that was put into their minds. Even though you don't see the faces, you know the actions you're taking today are going to impact tomorrow and the next day. And but maybe you don't even know how, but take as much care as you can in those decisions because it'll ripple out one way or the other.
So. And I'm sure, I mean, we had people, we mentioned Joseph Brand, we mentioned just in general people who lived at that time, at the time mostly were living in the Mohawk Valley. They faced with this very, very, this event or these crises that came thrown on there, they're going and they're saying, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Can you try to imagine them trying to make these decisions, knowing that a decision here might make, be some very hurt many of the people, but it was the decision to make. And then you're asking, you're probably asking some, you know, very, very, very traumatic.
And, you know, they've been hit with so many different things, warfare, epidemics. And like, so there was so much happening in their world. Right.
Well,
So, again, the time just seems to have flown by and we ran out of time again in our discussion around this whole history, you know. And all I could say with all of this discussion that we've already had is, again, we've only, you know, scratched the surface even with a lot of these issues. We didn't even really get into what we initially wanted to on being in Ganawagi, you know, 300 years. But it just goes to show that all we can really do with the short time that we have is to, you know, give what stories we can, but also to encourage people that if they really want to know more about these events, to really get out there and open up those books, sit with historians.
If I could plug the Cultural Center, you know, we have such an extensive resource center, our library. We have such rare documents, books that are there. And if anybody is interested in coming down, I'd be more than happy to point people in the direction of what they're interested in researching. And I know I might have touched on this last time, but I have a recommended reading list. If people want to come down to the Cultural Center, I'd be happy to print them up a copy.
And, you know, for our youth to try to take the interest in this, because I know a lot of our high schoolers who go to, say, survival school, they have access to this. They're taught this history. And so really, you know, take the time that this is, this stuff is gold, because
it is.
What it leads out to, what we can really reach out towards in our history and leading it up until today, it's
fascinating. It's just like to try to look back and see what all of these things, how they impacted, how one event impacted on another, and how people may have made decisions that they sometimes didn't want to make.
And it's like there's so much in there that we have to help revitalize today. that really helps towards our decolonization. You know, we talk a lot about that today because how we've been colonized. But looking at the language, the way we had run politically, ceremonially, the who we were, you know, and looking at how do we bring these things back? Because there was the attempt of erasure, right? But we're fortunate today because we have full access to a lot of these resources. And like yourselves, you know, the knowledge that you guys have and that you're carrying. Again, like last week, I just want to say, you know, Nyawako for coming in. You know, hopefully we can continue this conversation. Maybe we'll have another episode where we have more talks, or maybe next year when we start this programming over, you know, we'll be able to delve more into it. But to our listeners, take the time, get out there and learn. We have a lot of resources, like they always said at the Culture Center. We have a lot of teachers there, and just to really give that encouragement out. So once again, Nyawa to our two guests for coming in tonight. And up next, we have Cousins Dance. Nyawa Goa, we'll be right back.